Hello, and welcome back to New Books in National Security. I'm Beth Windisch, your host, and today we will be talking with Mark Hamm and Ramon Spy about their new book, The Age of Lone Wolf Terrorism. Mark and Ramon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Mark, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a professor of criminology at Indiana State University and have been in the field of terrorism research since the late 80s when I started to look at the rise of the skinhead groups across the country. And from there, I went into the militia movement and I wrote two books on the Oklahoma City bombing. And all of this happened before 9/11. So then since 9/11, my scope is broadened to include, you know, jihadi terrorism and then eventually into the move with Ramon on lone wolf terrorism. So that's sort of a snapshot of my career.
Great. Ramon, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. Quite a different career trajectory in some respects. I'm currently a professor of sociology at Victoria University in Australia and the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And I kind of came I have a number of sort of areas of research, but one of the prominent ones is study on terrorism, violent extremism. And particularly from sort of the mid-2000s, so quite a later stage, commencing research, particularly for a major project funded by the European Commission. One particular component of that study related to this notion of lone wolf terrorism. And that kind of initially triggered my interest. And it's basically from there where I wrote a report that was reasonably well received. That I sort of started working on some further project in this area, which culminated in my 2012 book and subsequently, as Mark mentioned, our collaboration on this this recent project.
Great. Could you tell us about how this book came into being?
I can address that. It was in 2011, the National Institute of Justice and the U.S. Department of Justice issued a call for grants, a call for proposals for a series of projects on domestic radicalization. And I had been, since I'd back beginning in the late 70s, I'd come to the conclusion in one book that Timothy McVeigh was a lone wolf. And I began to doubt that almost immediately after the book was published. And I began to look deeper into the Oklahoma City bombing and determined that, you know, that was really a stretch. That McVeigh was assisted by at least Terry Nichols and perhaps others, and that this was a broader conspiracy, which, you know, sort of brought me full circle to the question, well, then what is a lone wolf terrorist? And when you search the internet on this topic, this one report kept coming up, and it came out of the Netherlands, but there was no name attached to it. But it was a fascinating report, and I thought, well, I'm going to use this report as the basis for the Institute of Justice project, but I got to find out who authored this report. And so I kept digging and digging, and finally I found that it was Ramon, and we'd never met. And so I said, you know, what attracted me to Ramon's work was his clarity of thinking, that here was somebody who wasn't trying to impress you with his theoretical knowledge or impress you with all sort of whiz-bang statistics. But what he was doing was he was being very methodical in his use of terms. And I was very impressed with that clarity of thinking. And so I contacted Ramon. I said, I'm typically a lone wolf myself. You know, I hardly ever collaborate with somebody. But this was, Ramon had done such a fine job with that. I said, you know, I'm going to throw in with this guy if he wants to. And thankfully, he was interested in doing that. And so we put together this project for the National Institute of Justice, and we were funded for it. And then, so that was 2011, 2012, all the way through 2015 when we completed that project. And then from there, we took off and we summarized everything in this book that became The Age of Lone Wolf Terrorism. So that is how the collaboration came about. And to this day, There are only a handful, maybe five, you can count on one hand, the number of academic books that have been written on this topic. And so, you know, that's to the extent, what our contribution, I think, is that we come up here with this clearly identified pathway or model for understanding the radicalization of individuals who end up committing terrorism on their own.
So from time to time, we see some disagreement about the term lone wolf come up in articles and journals. Can you talk about what the term means and how you use it?
Sure. Now, you're absolutely right. So it's quite a contested term, not just among sort of scholars, but also, for example, in law enforcement community, right? So one of the criticisms of it might be that it, for example, glamorizes this type of criminal activity. And also, one might say, well, how useful is a metaphor like that when we're looking at, for example, at wolf biology and when we're comparing it to human behavior? So there's a number of these critiques, which we Mike and I have discussed at length. I think the way we use it in this book, so let me start by just explaining how we apply it, is to really focus on, at a kind of more practical level, at this sense of operational independence. So these are individuals that are not acting as part of, as members of, or being directed by an extremist group or cell or network. And in that sense, they kind of choose their own targets. They don't radicalize in isolation. So I'll explain that in a minute, what I mean by that. But basically, they're kind of operating on their own, and in a way, also, they conceive themselves as such. So as soldiers, as warriors for a particular cause, and they, in that process, they seek to become historical figures through their violent acts, actually individuals who potentially change the course of history. So there's a quite sort of strong sense of individual sort of honor, purpose, meaning involved in that. What we see in the process, obviously, that's one of the critiques saying, well, and Mark raised this in his example of Timothy McVeigh, how alone are many of these individuals? Well, indeed, a lone wolf doesn't operate in a social or political vacuum, right? So, and we'll talk about that later, but in the book we make a big case for, hey, we need to still look at how these individuals interact with their broader social environments to really understand how this, for example, this radicalization process works. And so also when we think about prevention strategies, we still need to think about, for example, about the fact that many of these lone wolves actually love to talk, and they probably talk too much because they want to seek renown for their cases, and they like to communicate their violent intentions to the outside world. Otherwise, the act is, in a sense, meaningless, right? And so I take those critiques. So personally, I understand where they're coming from. But I would say there's absolutely no empirical evidence that this terminology has ever glamorized any of these actors. If Mark can talk about this later, when we talk about a direct contact with these individuals, they didn't even necessarily frame themselves in terms of this lone wolf using that exact terminology at all. And also that there are actually some interesting parallels, for example, with lone wolves, how they operate sort of in nature, and particularly how many of these individuals over time have sought to belong to a group, either a physical group or a virtual community online, for example. And often they are sort of drifters, so they've sought a sense of belonging in groups, but they've never quite found it. They never really fit kind of socially or, in a group. Or they felt the group was not extreme enough, was a lot of talk but no action. And so the group felt that these were undisciplined characters who were a liability. So for a number of reasons, we see kind of dynamics that we actually also see in fact, in lone wolves who seek to belong to packs, but for a variety of reasons may drift in and out of packs over time, but also always looking for that sense of kind of belonging and purpose. So Mark might want to add to that, but this is a few initial sort of my thinking around this kind of question.
Yeah, I would only add one thing is that you're right in identifying these critiques of the term lone wolf terrorism. But many times what the critics overlook there is that it wasn't us, it wasn't academics who designed, who initiated the use of this term. It was indeed the FBI. And the FBI drew that term from a small group of white supremacists operating during the Reagan administration. And they used that term to identify this standalone terrorist, this lone actor terrorist. And they continue to use that term up to today. President Obama used that term repeatedly. So this is not a pie in the sky theoretical academic term. Indeed, it is just the opposite. It's seen as a valid analytical tool by practitioners. And so the critics must first deal with that issue when they begin to attack those of us who use this term.
Great, thank you. So the book, and Ramon, you hinted to this a little bit, some of the themes. The book lays out the model of radicalization and the different stages. Could you walk us through the radicalization model of lone wolf terrorism?
Okay, I'll take that first, and Ramon can add to it. All right, there are five phases to this model, and I'll go through them one at a time. The first is that the lone wolf. First of all, let me tell you how we got to this. We got to this, but this is empirically based. In other words, we identified 123 lone wolf terrorists between 1940 and mid 2016, and we analyzed these 123 lone wolves across 21 different variables. So we're coming up with in the neighborhood of 2,500. Original data points. Now, I say all that to make the point is that this is not a theoretical model. It is not abstract. It has been empirically verified. And so let me now state what the five steps are. One, the lone wolves tend to mix personal vendettas with a political grievance. All right, so they have a personal frustration and a political frustration that tend to get melded together. Two is that these individuals tend to have some affinity with an either an extremist group or an online sympathizer. Now, what affinity means is that there is some sort of nuanced liking of these other groups. You know, they find something in these groups that they want to model themselves after, or they find something appealing about these groups. Now, that is and that typically in the post 9/11 era, it does not mean face-to-face contact. Right? So this is very important. So they are being influenced through the internet, through virtual means. So therefore, this is a fundamental change in the way radicalization occurred as opposed to the pre-internet era. The third step in the model is an enabler. Now, this is an individual who has attracted widespread media attention because of his or her, typically is his political violence, his terrorism, his extreme beliefs. And people, lone wolves, tend to have a great deal of empathy for these people and look upon them as role models of a sort. And they typically are people who are no longer living. And I'll just name probably among white supremacists to this day around the world, 60 years after his death, Adolf Hitler is still in such an influential figure, iconic figure, that he inspires through his example acts of terrorism by neo-Nazis. On the other side of the jihadist side of the column, both Anwar al-Awlaki and Osama bin Laden, both dead for a number of years now, they continue to inspire jihadists. So these are enablers. These are people who inspire by example. The fourth step is a broadcasting of intent. As Ramon mentioned, these people, they seek renown for their beliefs. They talk too much about their beliefs. And matter of fact, we use a term in the book, oversharing. These guys they want to be known for their beliefs, and many times they want people to know that what they're going to do. So this is a deep psychological process dealing with identity and dealing with a sense of renown for their beliefs. The fifth is a triggering event. These triggering events can either be personal, political, or some combination of the two. We find this is the political are just as important as the personal. The political events tend to be, for example, when the when ISIS released a video recording calling for acts of violence against the West during Ramadan 2016. This became an event that triggered Omar Mateen's assault on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Mateen was a lone wolf in waiting. But he needed something to spark it, a catalyst to set it off. And so that was what the triggering event was for Mateen. So in other words, in all 123 of these cases, we see every element there that I've mentioned showing up in the majority of cases. This leads to terrorism. Now, in about 30% of the cases, we see a copycat effect, so that whole cycle begins all over again. Two other comments about the model. One, it's not necessarily linear. In other words, there's not a lockstep model where people have to go through each successive phase to become a terrorist. It is more of a heuristic or learning device so that people can begin to understand, get an appreciation for the specific behavior, and this is the key word in our approach. These are behavioral indicators, something you can witness, something you can see. We are not all apathetic bystanders watching these things go by. And so you can see these things and you can act on them. And we provide some examples in the book where lone wolf attacks have indeed been stopped because bystanders, parents, teachers, gun store clerks, have reacted to some of these characteristics. So I think I'll leave it at that. That's a summary of what we call the radicalization model of lone wolf terrorism.
Thank you. The data that you use to form the model is frequently grouped by pre-9/11 and post-9/11 events. How did dividing the data inform your analysis?
Yeah, I think a key point there is, as Mark mentioned, right? So we're covering a very large period, so 1940 to 2016. And so what we were interested in, and what are some of the developments, both continuities and changes over time? What are some of the patterns? Where do we see changes? And one of the prominent changes, for example, is with regard to targets, and particularly the increasing targeting of military personnel and law enforcement, but also look at some of the continuities. And so obviously there's different ways to do it. So we look in the book in a number of instances. We do that more, for example, by decade, or we do it by looking at some of the critical case studies, really, what we call the paradigmatic case studies that really exemplify sometimes a shift or discontinuity in some of the key trends. But what we also found is to be quite useful is to look sort of at pre and post 9/11 and look at, what are some of the key features, similarities, patterns of lone wolf terrorism before and after. And I think there are strengths and weaknesses to that. And I think it helps us to actually make visible some of the more subtle changes that have occurred over time. Yet, obviously, those changes don't necessarily always neatly align with the pre and post 9/11. So, for example, I'm thinking, and we do this explicitly in the book, we also highlight some other dates, such as particularly, for example, the election of former President Barack Obama as a key point, particularly in where we start seeing some shifts in patterns of lone wolf extremism among, for example, anti-government and right-wing extremists. So, I think it's always useful to look at particular dates, times, time periods in order to be able to identify continuities and changes. But at the same time, I think there are more than just a pre and post 9/11. Mark, you want to add to that?
We could do a whole hour on this. On a methodological level, if in order to determine whether things have changed longitudinally over time, you need some demarcation. in experimental research terms, you need a pre and a post test, if you will. And so by splitting the data between a pre and post 9/11 era, we have effectively provided the demarcation so that we can make comparisons. In other words, you can't say that lone wolf terrorism is changing in any substantive way without having such a timeline. And so strictly on a methodological level, a science, social scientific level, it makes a lot of sense to do that. This allows you to make discoveries. For example, we found five women of the pre-9/11 era who were lone wolf terrorists. All of them were assassins. We have seen none in the post-9/11. Why are there no women assassins anymore who come out of this lone wolf terrorism beck? Why is that? This is an interesting question, sociologically, criminologically, an issue for women's studies. So this is just one finding that we were able to discover by making that demarcation, by making that, drawing that line in the sand and say, okay, what has happened over time?
Yeah, another finding with that demarcation came up in the radicalization chapter. And let's just say the bar graph is very telling about the rise of the internet and its impact. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. This is you don't want to get tautological here, but the fact that the internet wasn't around prior to 9/11, so that there were other ways, other methods by which these individuals developed affinity for extremist causes. And they typically did that they'd either belong to an extremist group like the Ku Klux Klan, and oftentimes didn't find the Klan violent enough or extreme enough. And so a lone wolf does, he splits from the pack and goes out on his own and becomes an independent operator. Now, along comes the internet and the rise of chat rooms and the rise of propaganda online, bomb-making material online, purchasing firearms online, the whole bit. And the face of radicalization begins to change. And so after 9/11, the majority of the radicalization, the locus or place of radicalization, was no longer the extremist group, but was now online. And this radicalization came through through an affinity between anonymous online sympathizers. Now, we've got people here who were radicalized to go off to Syria to fight with ISIS in their jihad, and they had done so through communicating online with people who had never set foot in Syria. All they were doing was they were confirming and pushing and inspiring and promoting this jihad, even though they had no direct experience with it. So that's an important post 9/11 development that every think tank on terrorism, every domestic terrorism, international terrorism bureaucracy in Washington has dealt with and continues to deal with. Millions of dollars have been spent on trying to figure out how to do counter-radicalization online. Matter of fact, it's sort of a cottage growth industry.
The book makes a point of highlighting your direct correspondence and interviews with convicted terrorists. What did you gain from those experiences that added context beyond the data you gathered through more indirect sources?
Now, the first thing you gain is a lot of frustration. In universities, if any of your listeners do research in through the university, you know that you have to get human subjects approval through an institutional review board, an IRB. First primary research on criminals of any sort is a lengthy process. To do it on imprisoned terrorists is outright torturous. You have to go through IRB processes. You have to get permission from the Bureau of Prisons, the FBI, Homeland Security, CIA, if the inmate is a foreign national. Then you need permission from the inmate, his lawyers, and the warden of the prison. And it took us 2 years to get IRB permissions on the handful of inmates that we had direct contact with. Now, having said that, once you get this is you are provided with some rich data that nobody has ever seen in open sources. Even law enforcement, we can find ourselves with people that FBI has investigated that we are able to find out things about, because we don't present any sort of law enforcement hammer, you know. We're not intimidating people. We're there as social scientists to try to figure out what caused these people to behave the way they have. And so through this, particularly the prison interview, split those interviews up into 2 days. And so, you know, you're looking at 4 to 5 hours per day. And so at the end of that 2-day session, and these are all just one-on-one or small places where we're doing these, never two inmates, and these inmates are usually accompanied by a warden, because they're high profile inmates. Through that interaction, again, you know, you kind of start slow with questions the inmate is comfortable in asking. And over time, you develop a rapport with this inmate. And so he begins to trust you. And after he trusts you, then you move very incrementally to the larger issues of radicalization. Then finally, the last place as you go is you go to the act of terrorism in yourself. You simply don't walk in and boom, ask a guy, why'd you do it? This is stupid, right? You have to understand, be respectful of this person you're interviewing. You know that this took a lot of, this person was willing to risk his life, gamble, throw away his life in order to commit this act of violence. Now, to get to there, to get to that position where he wants to tell you about that, demands a lot of confidence, interpersonal confidence, and rapport building. And so, you know, this comes through letter writing at the front end of this, and then speaking to the guards and counselors and people. I've also interviewed the family members and gone to the neighborhoods where they committed these acts of terrorism. And so you know the layout of the land. And so by the time you get to the prison to interview these people, you know things about them. You know, you might walk in, see, you had a birthday a week ago. Well, they brighten up. So this guy has taken the time to know me. Or I walk through your neighborhood and I see where your sister lives. She's still there. Everything's okay. And so this is rapport building. So you're treating these people not as, quote, human subjects, but as actual really human beings. And so the long and short of it is that it is very difficult. It is torture. It's time consuming. It is frustrating in the extreme. That's the negative part of it. The positive part of it is you reap a bounty that is very unusual and is very deep. And, you know, it sort of provides a whole new way of looking at this phenomenon of terrorism.
I found it interesting that you identified previous criminal activity, and in particular instances of domestic violence, as a strong commonality in lone wolf terrorists. What does this information tell us about these actors?
Yeah, I think that was one of the, maybe not so much surprising, but very interesting findings. And I think, criminal activity, histories of criminal activity in general, but also particularly the domestic violence. It's something that I'm particularly a mark. We've had many discussions also about in terms of what this means, particularly also in terms of, and Mark referred earlier to, there being so few, and particularly none in the post-9/11 era, female lone wolves. What does this mean also between the link between, say, masculinity and violence as a means of, in the performance of masculinity, for example? And so what we found, so there's a number of things, so that in the post-9/11 era, particularly, we saw that interpersonal conflicts of these male lone wolves with women, for example, their girlfriends or wives, quite often featured as sort of triggering events, particularly, for example, when these women announced their intention to leave an abusive relationship, for example. And that actually became points at which they either got threatened or assaulted, and so where there were specific acts of very serious domestic violence. The other thing we saw in that process is that almost in some cases, the home environment became almost sort of a training ground where these male lone wolves could sort of rehearse and perfect the use of violence against their own families, and almost as sort of a stepping stone towards future attacks. So even in terms of the the socialization into the use of violence, right, and gaining some sort of confidence in the use of violence, we found that sort of the home environment in a few of these cases, particularly in the post 9/11 era, played quite a significant role. So that for me personally, that was, well, maybe not surprising, but it's quite a very, very interesting, I think, an eye-opening finding. And therefore, we're seeing links between this particular form of crime and other forms of criminal activity and illegal behaviors. So, Mark, you might want to add to that.
I admit that this is a very intriguing finding, and I've thought a lot about it, and I don't have a complete answer to this. The question is, why do lone wolves increasingly attack women? There's a much more to do in that area, and they're revolving around issues of masculinity, issues, obviously chauvinistic beliefs, misogyny. One of the interesting things that you find is that none of these guys in the post 9/11 era were in the military and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. We found a number of guys pre 9/11 who were World War II vets and Korea and Vietnam vets. But none of these guys post 9/11 fought in uniform in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet some of those guys were took high velocity firearms and went and killed groups of women. Now there's a story in there, and there's a shift in there. There's a transformation going on there with regard to this particular type of criminality that is very interesting, very troubling. I think one of the most harrowing stories we tell in the book is the assassination attempt of Representative Gabriel Giffords by mentally ill young man Jared Loeffner in Tucson in 2011. That was a particularly brutal crime. And as Ramon was mentioning, these guys see themselves as often historical figures. There is some chance that Gabby Giffords was on her way to a splendid career in politics. I mean, she had a very bright future. That was snuffed out in one instant. And there's another example of how these people are very dangerous and, very brazen. Walk right up to that woman, shot her point blank in the forehead. It was horrible. Now, why a woman? There are other politicians around. Why her? What was it that moved him to hate this woman so much? So these are part of deep psychological issues going on here. What we did, we didn't go into this looking for this. This is not a deductive process. It was all inferential. Oh, my God. Once we got done, we looked back at the data. We saw this. There's this pattern going on. Now, this is what true social science hopes to achieve, is not to go into with any predetermined notions, but let the data speak to you. And this was one of the most compelling findings we made, this issue about women.
Yeah, I wanted to just say that I found that section on the Gabby Giffords assassination attempt to be just really detailed. And I'll note that the book has several of these kind of examples throughout it that provide a lot of detail and context to these different attacks and a lot of background that give you a real holistic overview of all the different pieces. I also just wanted to touch upon that you, towards the end of the book and even in other places, you talk about the FBI sting operations and the role of those sting operations in counterterrorism efforts. Could you talk a little bit about those and what you found?
The FBI sting operations against lone Muslim males is the federal government's most ambitious attempt to control this problem of lone wolf terrorism. And what this amounts to is sending an undercover informant. That's a redundancy. All informants are undercover by definition. But sending typically these are criminals. Somebody's been caught and busted for a crime, and the FBI notices that these people have a potential to become a confidential informant. And so what they'll do is they'll flip them. They'll say, all right, you're going away to prison for life, or we'll make you another deal. you go out here in such and such a community and find someone who has a proclivity, that's the legal term, a proclivity for committing an act of terrorism. And you begin to ensnare, you begin to encourage this person to commit an act of terrorism. Operating through the FBI, they begin to encourage these people to join a conspiracy to commit terrorism. Over time, undercover FBI agents then are added to the mix, and after 6-8 months, what you've got is a full-blown, what looks to be a terrorist conspiracy. What this is an attempt, and here is this is the contentious term, entrap these people into an act of terrorism. Now, what our argument is, and when we look at the interview these guys and look at their backgrounds, they didn't have the criminal skills to commit an act of terrorism, a bombing, let's say, by themselves. They didn't have the resources, the money, the vehicles, the know-how to commit these acts of terrorism. Only when the FBI intervened and radicalized these people were they able to go down this road eventually toward a terrorist event. Now, none of them are terrorist actions, because at the last minute, the FBI intervenes and arrests this person, and it usually gets reported as supported, providing material support or attempted bombing. But this is the sting. You know, the FBI has used stings in white-collar crime cases, mafia cases, and since 9/11, they've begun to apply it more and more. It happened before 9/11 too, but since 9/11, they've upped the ante, and they have doubled on their efforts to try to initiate these stings in Muslim communities across the country. There was one, according to James Comey before he left office, was that he said there were FBI investigations going on and terrorism investigations in all 50 states. But what he was talking about, these were sting operations that were going on. And so these are probably billion-dollar operations. And their intent is not really to stop an act of terrorism, but it is to demonstrate to the public that the FBI is indeed doing something about terrorism. And so what these need to be spectacular tales of a foiled plot. And then the media trots these people out and said, well, you know, we stopped another one. Well, they weren't really stopped. What we're arguing is that there's a better way to do this. You don't have to these guys go to prison for 30 years to life. There's a different way to do this. You don't have to encourage somebody to bomb other Americans. You can provide them with an off-ramp to the radicalization. Many of these guys are mentally ill, drug addicted. We found one guy who was so mentally ill, during this thing, he actually circumcised himself on the streets of Harlem. Now, there's a guy who you could probably do something different with rather than encourage him to bomb a subway. And there are other cases, many that this scenario follows. These are marginalized people with drug and alcohol problems, mental illness problems on the margins of society, and the FBI is exploiting them for their own reputation and to demonstrate so that they're winning the domestic war on terrorism. These are highly controversial operations. When you speak about, and Ramon can probably confirm this, when you explain these FBI terrorism stings to European audiences, they're appalled. Nothing like this happens in Europe. Nothing like this happens in the UK. These are a unique product of the FBI, and they have some roots back in the legacy of J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO and these programs to stop dissidents during the late 40s up through the to the early 70s.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mark. And just to add to that, you're absolutely right. So, for example, in the European context, they recognize this idea of, hey, you might have alternatives when one of these individuals comes onto your radar, right? You have some choices of which path do you follow, of which the sting operation is one. In Europe, for example, they're working particularly hard also to enhance the access of these individuals then to decent support So say mental health care, et cetera, to actually ensure that this person doesn't follow that path either to violence or to jail, and actually is offered opportunities to find, you know, well, A, improve health, but also B, to find meaningful opportunities in society. So there's actually, for example, in the European Union context, there are quite ongoing talks and programs around those kind of issues. So there's the awareness indeed of, hey, this presents us with decisions we need to make, but I think generally the consensus is that this is not the way we want to go. We actually want to see what we can do more on the preventative side, actually preventing these individuals from radicalizing any further, and actually gaining sort of meaningful opportunities to have a sense of sort of belonging and inclusion in society. So it's quite a different approach indeed.
Well, thank you both. I really enjoyed reading the book, and I will say, while it is very rich in data and sources, it's also an extremely accessible read. Before we let you go, would you mind telling us what you are both working on now?
Well, not much. I'm basically, in the last 8 months or so, I've been reacting to invitations, you know, wrote a book chapter on protest music and why it matters in the Trump era. You know, we're seeing protest music, it ain't what it used to be. But we haven't seen marches like we have during Donald Trump's presidency. And so I'm asking the question in an article about, you know, what role does music, protest music, is there any way, like through rap, you know, can we somehow replicate, you know, what Pete Seeger or Dylan or Woody Guthrie did in earlier eras, you know, that seems, does Eminem or, Chance the Rapper, or Lil Wayne, or can that be expressed through rap music? That's intriguing me. I also have done a piece on appearance and crime, appearance and terrorism. I've written another piece on ethnography, you know, sort of the trials and tribulations of doing ethnography. So that's about it.
Yeah, I'm working on a few different projects. One is related to the end of our discussion around sting operation, but particularly also the mental health. So a project around the role of mental health, mental illness, but also particularly the other way in mental health care can actually be a sort of a protective factor in radicalization or de-radicalization processes. And also a project where we look particularly at the point of transition from sort of a sympathizer to someone to take up arms and become to violent extremism. And so what is it in that transition? And I think that builds quite naturally on the work that Mark and I've done. Other than that, I'm also trying to enjoy this achievement. It's a book I'm very proud of, and enjoyed the collaboration with Mark. So I think it's time also to just sit back and think, oh, what a great book we've written. So I think it's we don't often do that enough, even academics. We just go on to the next project without actually celebrating our little successes along the way. So I'm actually trying to do that a little bit more at the moment.
Yeah, that's the point.
Well, thank you both for being on the show today.
Okay. Pleasure. Thank you for having us.
The Age of Lone Wolf Terrorism by Mark Hamm and Ramon Spy is available now from Columbia University Press.